Introduce Molly Hemingway and Henry Olson. Molly Hemingway is the editor-in-chief of The Federalist. She is senior journalism fellow at Hillsdale College. A Fox News contributor, she is a regular member of the Fox News All-Star panel on Special Report with Brett Baer. Her work has appeared in The Wall Street Journal, USA Today, The Los Angeles Times, The Guardian, The Washington Post, CNN, National Review, Get Religion, Ricochet, Christianity Today, Federal Times, and Radio and Records, as well as many other publications. Molly was a 2004 recipient of a Robert Novak Journalism Fellowship at the Fund for American Studies and a 2014 Lincoln Fellow of the Claremont Institute. She is the co-author of Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation, and the Future of the Supreme Court. She is also the author of Rigged, How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections. Henry Olson, a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, studies and provides commentary on American politics. His work focuses on how America's political order is being upended by populist challenges from left and right. He also studies populism's impact in other democracies in the developed world. Mr. Olson is an opinion columnist for the Washington Post, where he writes daily pieces focusing on politics, populism, foreign affairs, and American conservative thought. He is also the author of Working Class Republican, Reagan and the Return of Blue-Collar Conservatism, and The Four Faces of Republican Party, co-authored with Dante Scala. Mr. Olson was previously an editor at unheard.com and a regular contributor to American Greatness, City Journal, and World Magazine. Mr. Olson's work has been featured in many prominent publications, including The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, National Review, The Guardian, and The Weekly Standard. Mr. Olson has worked in senior executive positions at many center-right think tanks. He most recently served from 2006 to 2013 as Vice President and Director, National Research Initiative, at the American Enterprise Institute. He previously worked as Vice President of Programs at the Manhattan Institute and President of the Commonwealth Foundation. He started his career as a political consultant at the California firm of Hoffenblum Mollrich. He then worked with the California State Assembly Republican Caucus before attending law school. He served as a law clerk to the Honorable Danny Boggs of the U.S. Court of Appeals of the Sixth Circuit, a Philly Sock member, and as an associate at Deckert, Price, and Rhodes. He has a BA from Claremont McKenna College and a JD from the University of Chicago School of Law, where he served as a comment editor for the University of Chicago Law Review. It is now my great pleasure to give the floor to Mr. Olson.
There goes my desire of being unchained to the man. The election system in the United States is essentially on trial, and today can be considered to be akin to arguments before a jury. You, ladies and gentlemen, are the jury. But we have a question which hasn't really been answered. I'm going to defend the existing system, but do I take the burden of the defense? Which is to say, do I only need to demonstrate a reasonable doubt as to the prosecution's allegation of misuse, fraud, and basic malfeasance? Or do I need to take the prosecution? Do I need to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the system is secure despite occasional errors? I'm going to take the greater burden on myself, and I will try and demonstrate that the system is secure. I will try not to simply point out points of security, but rather try and suggest that the entire system, from start to finish, is largely immune from wide-scale manipulation or wide-scale fraud. That would mean that the result does not represent the will of the voters. The question I'm going to answer in the affirmative is this: does America's election system accurately record and report the results of legally cast ballots by legally eligible voters in an election? The answer is indubitably yes. Now, you might be surprised to hear that in light of things that you've heard over the last few months and last few years, and I am not claiming that the system is flawless. We have thousands of jurisdictions that administer elections in the United States. Each has tens to hundreds of precincts underneath it. There are so many moving parts in this system that it would be amazing if it were utterly and completely flawless. What I am saying is that there's no systemic flaw in any jurisdiction in the country that gives rise to a reasonable doubt that the system in that jurisdiction works. All elections in the United States have three parts, and I'm going to go through each in turn. The first is the registration of voters. The second is the method of casting of the ballots. And the third is the method of counting of the ballots. None are immune from problems. All are substantially secure. First, let's talk about registration. I'm going to presume, given that you have paid a significant amount of money to either join a politically inclined organization and or spend additional money to come to this event, that you are all registered to vote, which means you're inclined to know what registration to vote means. Congratulations. One quarter of your fellow citizens are not. They choose to be so disengaged from the American political system that they don't even bother to put their names on the register that allows them to cast a vote. However, the question about registration is not whether your registration is accurately recorded. We all know that it is. The question is whether or not there are people who are not legally eligible to vote who are also on the rolls. And the question then is, if there are, do those people cast votes in significant numbers that they actually determine the outcome of the elections? Now, one could imagine a registration system that would be better than the one we have. When I was young, rolls were purged every year. After every two-year election, if you didn't vote in the general election or the primary election, you were removed. You had to register in person. That's now been replaced with the decentralized system, where you're registered at the motor vehicle department, you register yourself online, and you're not removed unless you haven't voted in two consecutive federal elections. But despite that, and despite obvious problems with respect to the maintenance of the rolls, there's little to no evidence that there's a substantial number of people who are not legally eligible to vote who are actually casting ballots. Now, there are two types of people who are usually brought up when people try and argue that there are. Those are people who are non-citizens, whether here legally or non-legally, and those are people who are inactive or deceased or in otherwise non-voters who suddenly come to life when fraudsters engage this inactive registration. With respect to the illegal voter, there's virtually no example of significant numbers of illegal people casting ballots. How do we know this? We know this because we can actually know where those people live. We have something called the Citizens Voter Aged Population Numbers that are produced each year by the Census Bureau by looking at the American Community Survey, which surveys hundreds of thousands of people nationwide each year and asks questions about citizenship. If the Trump administration had been smart, they wouldn't have fought to get the citizenship question on the short form of the law of the census. They would have mandated that the reapportionment data include the five-year average, which is accurate at any sort of census level that is required for redistricting. But I digress. The citizens' aged voter population may not be 100% accurate. In other words, there might be people who are non-citizens who lie to the survey takers. But an amazing number are actually tell the truth, so that we have a pretty clear examples of areas that have low numbers of citizens in areas that have high numbers of citizens. What we see is that the number of votes cast in areas with low numbers of citizens are, in fact, substantially lower. Not marginally lower, not a little bit lower, dramatically lower. Let me give you the example of Nevada. Nevada has four congressional districts. The congressional district that has the highest number of known non-citizen adults is the one, and I'm talking about the lines that were in effect in 2020, not the newly redistricted lines, that basically occupies downtown Las Vegas and some of the near-in suburbs. In 2020, 223,213 people cast ballots in that congressional district. The largest number of votes was cast in the neighboring district that represents the highest educated area and among the least number of non-citizen voters, 417,252. Now, consider that Nevada was decided by less than 3 percentage points of the vote, which means it was decided by less than 30,000 votes. If there were fraudsters who were engaging in a massive number of illegal votes, you've got 200,000 votes sitting in District 1 that you could have brought up and registered and voted to ensure that there was never any doubt that your side was going to win the election. But that doesn't happen. It doesn't happen because illegal people are, by and large, not voting. There's not a conspiracy to bring them to the polls. The same thing happens in other places. Consider California 21. California 21 in 2020 was a marginal district. David Valadao, a former congressman, had lost in the 2018 wave, and he's trying to regain his seat from T.J. Cox. This happens to be an area in the Central Valley with a large number of Latino farm workers. One can guess how many of those are actually citizens. I'll leave it to you. But the fact is, 172,000 people voted for president in that district. Mr. Valadao won his seat back, defeating Mr. Cox, by a narrow, narrow margin. Compare this to another marginal seat in an area well to the south, the area of Orange County and where Orange County meets Diamond Bar in Los Angeles and a bit of San Bernardino County on the side. This is the district that Young Kim regained for Republicans in 2020 after losing in 2018. 351,000 votes were cast there. Consider the district slightly to the south that Katie Porter represents, a highly educated area including Newport Beach and Irvine. 418,000 votes were cast there. Consider the district where my father lives, District 4, the one then represented by Tom McClintock, which is basically the retirement areas and the exurbs of Sacramento. 428,000 people were voting there. All you needed was an extra 3,000 votes in that illegal dominated district in David Valadao's area, and you would have had T.J. Cox come back. Massive incentive, even though California is a blue state, to turn out people, falsely register them, and bring them to the polls. Didn't happen because it doesn't happen in large numbers. Now let's consider the question of inactive and dead voters. There are too many people who are on the rolls who shouldn't be. There should be more regular purging of the rolls and updating of the rolls. But what we do not see is inactive voters suddenly becoming active when incentives kick in. If there was wide-scale ability to manipulate and fraudulently control the system, that's the sort of thing you would see. The sort of person who a fraudster would identify no longer lives in the area or is deceased, clearly is somebody who is not going to contest your ability to cast their vote for them. You then register that person for a mail ballot, and voila, you've cast an illegal vote. Doesn't happen. People who are inactive on the rolls stay inactive on the rolls. People who are dead, by and large, don't vote, or have people vote for them. And there is the occasional example of the person who voted for his dead mother, or the person who cast a ballot as, you know, that she was alive when the ballot was requested and died when the ballot was actually delivered. There's actually a case like that. But again, these are rare. These are anecdotes. They're anecdata. They don't swing elections. Now, the balloting. There are four types of ballots that are generally used in the United States. There's mail-in ballots that are obtained without having an excuse. There's, in many states, early in-person voting, where you go to one of many centralized locations and cast a vote in person in the same manner as if you were doing it on election day. There's the election day in-person voting. And then there's provisional voting. And provisional voting is something that was added nationwide as a part of the Help America Vote Act in 2002 after what happened in Florida. And what is... So I now know I've used 11 minutes of my 20. What that means is that, say you go to a precinct, and you're not on the rolls there, but you say, hey, I'm legally able to vote. And this can be for a number of reasons. It could be that your registration wasn't updated in time, or it could be as I've cast a provisional ballot. I went to my old or my new precinct rather than my old precinct because I had moved, and or my old precinct rather than my new precinct, I forget which one I went to. I was on the rolls, but I was in the wrong place, so I cast a provisional ballot, and that is basically you cast a ballot as if you were casting it by mail, and you sign it, and they put it off to the side, and then after the election, they check whether or not you're validly registered and whether your vote should be counted or not. There's no reason to think that any of these are being manipulated. Mail-in ballots have a lot of gaping holes. They can be manipulated, and it's one reason why we should rein in the use of them, encourage people to vote in person early, and also add security measures as countries that use widespread mail-in voting like Australia does. But there's no demonstration that these mail votes are actually being used to cast illegal votes. When mail-in voting is introduced, as it was, say, in Pennsylvania, and as it has been in many other states, you do not see sudden increases in turnout or unusual shifts in margins, which is the sort that you would expect if people are going to start using this new method to create fraudulent votes. You don't see it over time either. It's not like they're smart enough to not do it in year one, but they do it in year six. Any place that has instituted widespread mail-in voting has the same sort of voting patterns as they had, as those areas had before, once you account for various types of voting changes in the electorate and demographic changes of the area. Ohio, Florida, and North Carolina have large mail voting without excuse populations. They've been increasing that number over the last 20 years. They have not shifted to the left. In fact, Ohio and Florida have shifted to the right. Mail-in balloting can be manipulated, but it is not being manipulated. We can usually see when mail fraud does occur because of patterns that are violated. And that's an example that we observed in one case where mail fraud did happen. There was a special election in North Carolina. It was a long district that included Charlotte suburbs and went out into the rural areas. And what people after the fact noticed was that, hey, candidate X was winning the absentee ballots just about everywhere except in this one county where candidate Y won. But there's no reason to think that candidate Y would do better there. Candidate Y didn't do any better during the in-person vote. What's the excuse? The excuse was there was an entrepreneur who was running around collecting mail ballots and marking them up for people. He was committing mail fraud. You identify the possibility for fraud by identifying discrepancies in patterns that suggest it might have occurred. You will not find those discrepancies when you look at mail-in balloting throughout the United States. You will not find discrepancies in the 2020 election between high mail vote counties and their prior behavior and low mail vote counties and their prior behavior. Early in-person voting, again, it's the same as election day voting. So if your state requires voter ID, you have to present it. If your state doesn't require voter ID, you don't have to present it. So the real question with both those is, does the existence of voter identification deter large numbers of in-person and fraud, which is that always there significant numbers without voter identification of people who are impersonating people in person. Studies have shown over the last few years that there's virtually no change in turnout when states implement strict voter ID standards. Now, the good news is that you use these studies to say, hey, guess what, Democrats, 74% of Americans want these, and there's no voter suppression that happens. Isn't that great? The flip side is, it also shows there wasn't any fraud being deterred. Voter impersonation may happen, again, in the individual. There may be a case where somebody does impersonate somebody. It does not happen in the mass. Then you have the final system, provisional voting. Provisional voting is something that is rigorously checked. People look at those signatures and those requirements, and a large number of them are rejected. It's not a case where, after the words, the electoral agencies will simply wave a magic wand and say, oh, you said you could vote, therefore you must. You can take a look at the returns yourself, because these are all data that are announced. You can go take a look, even in highly Democratic areas or highly Republican areas. Many people are rejected when they vote provisionally, and many others, like I was found to be on the rolls, just in the wrong place, or had some other disability. So there's no reason to think that we have systemic manipulation of the actual balloting. So then that brings us to the final source, counting. Are the nefarious malfeasance manipulating the counting process? So, ballots are counted differently in different areas, but generally they fall into a couple of categories. First of all, machines of one sort or another do the counting, and they have to. The United States is the only country in the world that basically votes on somewhere between 10 and 50 or more issues simultaneously. Everywhere else in the world, when you go to the ballot box, you're either asked to have one question before you, whether or not you elect the member of parliament, or like in Sweden, which voted last Sunday, they had three different elections simultaneously, and they were given three different ballots to hand out. That means that everywhere else in the world, people count by hand, because you literally fill out a piece of paper, or in the case of Sweden, you take a piece of paper representing your party, and you stick it in an envelope and seal it, and then it's counted by hand. We can't do that. If we wanted to, we could. We could have people fill out a separate ballot for president, count it all by hand, we'd count that in one night, and then everything else would be left for tomorrow. But, which is what happens in those other countries, is that they counted the parliament first, and then they count the regional, and then they count, because there's only so many people that you can have counting things by hand. But so machines have to count. So then the question is, can we trust the machines that count? And the answer is, yes, we can. Why can we do that? First of all, machines are checked beforehand by members of both parties. Machine accuracy is checked in every jurisdiction in the country in a publicly available, you can go on your county or city's, whichever jurisdiction enables your website, and find out when are the machines going to be checked publicly before the election. It's public information. They are checked, and every party can go in and check whether or not X machine counts the ballots accurately. So before the election, they are checked. They are then checked after the election. And most importantly, we have something called a canvas. On election night, what you're getting is the quick unofficial total. We then have a period, which differs from state to state, but is usually 2 to 4 weeks, called the canvas period. And what that does is allow them to check for errors. It also allows them to do the crucial hand check. Now, what you do in these places is you select randomly precincts, and you count those ballots by hand for a certain number of races. And then you see, did they match the machine count? If they didn't, you've got a problem. But they usually, if not always, do. Let me give you an example that I researched that I know of specifically. Maricopa County in 2020, which you've probably heard, and that's where Phoenix is. It's the county that's alleged to have had many problems in the 2020 election. In Maricopa's system of canvas works like this. A few days after the election, a representative of each of the three major parties, three because the Libertarian Party is a registered party, sends representatives to the county recorder, and each representative randomly selects two precincts. So then they sit and they count, they look at four different races, and they see, does the printed ballot differ from the machine count? And the answer in Maricopa was not on a single race, it differed by a single vote. But for there to be a conspiracy, Democrats, Republicans, and Libertarians in Phoenix would all have to have conspired as to which six precincts in cahoots with the recorder's office to know exactly which ones had not been manipulated in difference to the ones that were manipulated. I leave it to you to decide whether or not that happened or whether or not, in fact, the machines counted things fairly. This happens in every jurisdiction because the system is secure and is made to ensure security. Anecdotes of misdeeds do not mean that any of those anecdotes actually caused an issue. It is extremely difficult to tamper with machines, and as I noted, it'll be caught after the fact. And adding votes, that is to say ballot stuffing, is extremely difficult. And if it did happen, it would be caught because of the patterns that I mentioned. If you're going to stuff ballot boxes in one jurisdiction but not elsewhere, you're going to create a pattern. Now, let me give you an example. I studied Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is almost a perfect place to do this because in 2016, they had no excuse absentee balloting and no in-person voting. So it was the Trump gold standard. You know, a couple people voting because they were sick or out of town, everyone else shows up on election day. 2020, they had no excuse mail voting. What did I find? I found that there was no relationship between, at a county level, and you can see this, I wrote this up in the Washington Post, just Google Henry Olson, Pennsylvania, 2020 election, and you'll find it. It was January of this year, I believe. First of all, what you find is that there's no relationship between the number of mail votes cast in a county and the Biden vote share, or more importantly, the shift in 2020 from 2016. You can have 70% mail ballots, you can have 17% mail ballots. The county doesn't shift towards the Democrats. You would expect to see that if mail votes were being manipulated to cast fraudulent ballots. You don't. Nor do you see turnout increases. And this is particularly important because of the allegations that Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, Allegheny County, stuffed the ballot boxes. In fact, Philadelphia, what I do to look at turnout is you compare the number of votes in each election to the number of citizen voting age population in the jurisdiction. And what you find is that Philadelphia had the second lowest increase of any of the counties. The only county that was lower was a county with Penn State, where presumably the students weren't voting because the campus wasn't open. You're stuffing a ballot, and Trump got more votes in 2020. So they didn't produce more votes overall, and Trump got more of them. If you're stuffing the ballot box, that's pretty incompetent. Allegheny was in the bottom. It only increased by like 5.7%, and it was on the bottom scale of the turnout increases. But more interestingly, what I found was that when you plot the 67 counties in Pennsylvania and their turnout, you come up with a bell curve. Bell curve is exactly what you would expect if the turnout by county is randomly distributed without account for other factors. There wasn't manipulation of the system in the Keystone State. So in conclusion, I'd like to say no system is perfect. We had a recount in New York's 22nd congressional district where their overseeing judge basically found incredible incompetence in one county, people who just didn't follow the law, not in favor of one candidate or another. These people were just incompetent on the margin. If it wasn't a simply cast ballot, they didn't know what to do with it. But by and large, from the registration to the casting to the counting, our system is secure. We can and should make it better, but you should be assured that in the absence of one of these cases, one of these examples of unusual activity that's not just anecdotes, but is borne out by large-scale data or large-scale activity, you can be secure that whether your candidate won or lost, the result actually represented the will of the voters in the jurisdiction that you were voting in.
Great. Well, Andrew told us that a republic cannot survive if the means for registering popular consent cannot be trusted. And he asked us if we can rely upon our elections as legitimate, fair opportunities to make the changes they seek, the changes we seek. He further said that we should focus on the present and the future, and I am very bad at following directions, so I'd like to go back a few hundred years. Beginning with the election of Zachary Taylor in 1848, the presidential election began to be held on a single day nationwide. By law, all voters were to decide together who would lead the country for the next 4 years on the Tuesday after the first Monday in November. The change to a single day of voting occurred out of concern for election integrity. The 1844 election, which had been spread out for more than a month, was rife with fraud and practices that put the election's legitimacy into question. Voters also feared that election outcomes in states with earlier election dates were influencing how later states voted. So we moved to one day. But by 2020, the practice of Americans voting on the same day had become a thing of the past. Hold on. Okay, sorry. And Americans had returned to what had been rejected in the 1840s, a lengthy window of time to conduct elections. That's not to say that there had not been exceptions for people who needed them prior to 1844. States had long permitted limited absentee voting for select citizens who could present legitimate reasons for why they were unable to go to the polls, such as military deployment. But beginning in the late 1970s, restrictions were seriously loosened. California was the first to allow no excuse absentee balloting, and then states across the country soon followed suit. And now the country has a months-long voting season. And that was true before 2020, when reforms seriously increased the length of time during which Americans could cast ballots to ludicrous proportions. North Carolinians, for example, could vote in the 2020 election before Labor Day, a full 2 months before Election Day, and nearly a month before the two candidates had met for the first debate. In Virginia right now, I think we started voting yesterday. The changes also obscured the deadline by which votes needed to be counted, a fixture of the system before 2020. Now people wait days, weeks, and sometimes months to find the outcome of elections. In 2016, absentee and mail-in ballots accounted for roughly 33 million of the 140 million ballots counted. In 2020, more than 100 million of the 159 million ballots counted were cast prior to Election Day, including by early voting. The change was enough for former Attorney General William Barr to sound the alarm about how widespread early absentee and mail-in voting was negatively affecting the voting public. Extending voting well beyond voting day, he said, is like telling a jury in a two-month trial that they can vote at any time they want during the trial. I got to interview him for my book, and he was telling me that you can't say it's really a national consensus because people are all operating on a different set of facts. The 2020 election also saw an even more important 19th century electoral reform put on the chopping block. And that was the move to the secret ballot that occurred in the late 1800s. So during the colonial period, there were many methods of voting, from using different colored beans or corn to cast votes, or viva voces, voice votes. In the latter system, each voter's name was called, and the voter was asked publicly before a judge, clerks, the candidates, and other voters whom he was voting for. The practice was abandoned in part because creditors would make their debtors vote for their preferred candidates, taking advantage of the public nature of the polls to ensure that debtors did their bidding. But as a rule, colonies moved to paper ballots early on. Governor John Winthrop, one of the leading figures in founding the Massachusetts Bay Colony, abolished public voting in 1634. By 1706, Pennsylvania had passed a law requiring the use of paper ballots, with provisions given for the illiterate. And by the end of the Revolutionary War, everyone had moved to paper ballots. Voting on paper used to mean remembering candidates' names and writing them down. But as the size and scope of government grew, as Henry was noting, so did the number of elected officials, and well-funded political parties began to print ballots with the names of their preferred candidates already on them. Political parties would give their pre-printed ballots a distinctive design. Democrats in 19th century Charleston, for example, printed red checked backs on their tickets. In Orangeburg County, South Carolina, Republicans made the backs of their tickets look like a playing card. Privacy critics warned that this opened the door once again to bribery and intimidation, as voters could be bullied into carrying into the voting area a recognizable ballot into the voting booth and making sure that they came out without it. To limit voter intimidation, some states required that ballots be printed on white paper without any distinguishing marks, guidelines that were easily flouted. In 1851, Free Soilers and Democrats passed a law requiring that votes be deposited in the ballot box in a sealed envelope. The envelopes were to be of the same size, color, and quality, and to be furnished by the Secretary of State to the town clerks, who would be stationed in the same room as the ballot box. Opponents of the law were later able to make it optional, which mostly meant that those who could be bribed would again continue to be bribed. Bribery and intimidation were such big issues that the 46th Congress of 1879 to 1881 issued a report detailing some of the problems that plagued our insecure voting systems. The report found that employees might be taken to the polls by their employer and compelled to show their ballots before they were cast. This was a particular problem, a particularly pronounced problem, I should say, in northeastern cities and industrial centers, some of the same places where we have problem with election integrity to this day. With political parties printing up the ballots that were to be used, coercion, intimidation, and outright fraud became common complaints. The purchasing of votes in exchange for liquor or money was common, and buying votes wasn't even a federal offense until 1925. Following a model originally developed in Australia, cities and states began to print official ballots that voters could take and cast in a secure environment. This made buying votes much more difficult, as there was no proof of how one had voted. In 1888, the first Australian ballot was used in Louisville, Kentucky. Clear rules were issued for how to get a candidate's name on the ballot. Massachusetts and New York used the system the same year. The practice spread across the country, and South Carolina became the last to adopt the Australian ballot in 1950. And states took the cost up of printing the ballots. Party machines and other interested parties didn't like the new system because it made it almost impossible to know whether attempted bribery had been successful or not. And verifiable instances of fraud plummeted. Many other practices were adopted to limit voter fraud and intimidation. States and municipalities began to keep voter rolls to limit precinct hopping and double voting. Privacy curtains were added to voting areas. Judges and observers from opposing parties were brought in to observe the casting of ballots to limit fraud from corrupt election commissions. The reforms greatly decreased the tumult of elections and increased public confidence in election results. As election rules across the country were gradually reformed to address corruption, the franchise was also expanded. For more than a century then, for nearly all, so women, minorities, everyone gets it expanded. For more than a century then, for nearly all voting Americans, election day meant going into a voting place and identifying oneself to a poll worker. You voted privately, perhaps behind a curtain with no one else to see how you voted. The move to early and mail-in voting took away some of that secrecy, along with the ability to detect fraud or coercion. Deviations from in-person election day voting are supposed to replicate the security and anti-fraud protocols a city or state has for in-person voting on election day. You know, ideally, early voting is basically just like voting on election day, just earlier. You go to a public place, you identify yourself, your name is checked off the rolls, you receive a ballot, you fill it out in secret, you cast the ballot into a locked box that will be counted on election day. Early voting hinges on public trust in election officials who take custody of ballots. You voters have to trust that election officials aren't playing games with the ballots in the weeks before election day or otherwise letting ballots be tampered with. Mail-in balloting varies widely from state to state. From an election integrity standpoint, once again, you're supposed to try to kind of emulate what happens in person. You may fill out the ballot at your kitchen table, but you're supposed to attest that you did it without coercion. You're supposed to sign to say that it really was your ballot. A signature is supposed to match a signature that's on file. You know, some states provide secrecy envelopes to kind of help you vote secretly and not under coercion from a family member or employer. So this is where there are many deviations from our system with the mail-in ballot. Prior to the 2020 election, the media and other partisans admitted that fact freely, that mail-in balloting was open to fraud. You know, France banned mail-in voting in 1975 because of how it was an easy opportunity for fraud. The 2005 Commission on Federal Election Reform, chaired by former President Jimmy Carter and former Secretary of State James Baker, declared that absentee ballots remain the largest source of potential voter fraud. The bipartisan commission was formed to address voting and election integrity issues following the razor-thin 2000 presidential election, which was adjudicated, of course, at the Supreme Court. A particular concern was how vulnerable voters might be coerced to vote in a way that more powerful people told them to. As they said, citizens who vote at home, at nursing homes, at the workplace, or in church are more susceptible to pressure, overt or subtle, or to intimidations. Vote buying schemes are far more difficult to detect when citizens vote by mail, the report said. A 2000 report by Caltech and MIT's Voting Technology Project concluded that the greatest fraud problems lie in absentee balloting and recommended that states restrict or abolish on-demand absentee voting in favor of in-person early voting. Further, the report stated that there is no evidence that liberalizing absentee voting laws or enacting early or vote-by-mail schemes has increased voter turnout dramatically, except under one condition, which is when the laws are sufficiently ambiguous or liberal to allow partisan forces to use them to boost the turnout of party loyalists. I will note at this point that in the most recent election, we had a $419 million campaign funded by Mark Zuckerberg, one of the world's wealthiest and most powerful men, in which he funneled money to two very left-wing organizations to overtake government election operations, handling everything from voter registration to ballot curing and everything in between. So precisely the issue, the one exception under which they said that you could affect the election. Not that long ago, the notion that mail-in ballots were problematic was the accepted wisdom in liberal media outlets. The New York Times said, voting by mail is now common enough and problematic enough that election experts say there have been multiple elections in which no one can say with confidence which candidate was the deserved winner. That was Adam Liptak in 2012. In an article headlined, Error and Fraud at Issue as Absentee Voting Rises. And then David Ferentold at the Washington Post said, absentee ballots are not the only way to fraudulently win an election, and said that selling votes was a common type of election fraud. I kind of want to leave at this point to go and respond to some of what Henry said, but I want to do it. I want to kind of conclude my remarks here, but also just there's one little additional thing, which is, the question is whether we can trust our elections and whether we can have confidence in them. And the fact is that there is a lot of variation in this country by jurisdiction in how elections are administered. There's also a lengthy history. We have had a history of election security issues. And the question isn't whether they're totally secure now or totally insecure recently, but really where we are on a continuum that we must always fight for. And we should be very mindful of how much work went into single day, in-person, secure, secret ballots, and be very wary of not just the, you know, confidence that when you move away from that, that you are having a heavily manipulated election, but just that the gift that is provided by moving to a closer and closer to a single day of secure balloting so that the country can kind of come to a decision, find out what that decision is quickly, and be able to move on in a healthy way. So, thank you.
I wouldn't necessarily disagree with anything that Molly said, except that I think that mail balloting, I don't have a problem with mail balloting. I do think it should be made more secure. In Australia, which has extensive, is one of the few countries in the world that has extensive early voting, both in person and out of precinct and by mail, like the United States, most countries don't have that. You know, what they do is they require you to give a security question if you want to vote by post. That's what they call them, postal votes. So, you know, like if Molly wanted to vote by mail, it would be, what's the, something like, what's the secret nickname my husband calls me? I say that because Mark's in the front row. And so that only she would know the answer to that. And then when she gets it, she has to put the answer down so that they can check it against what she sent in. And it has to be it has to be witnessed by somebody else. Now, of course, the Democrats say, we shouldn't have any of that stuff. Well, if it's good enough for Australia, I don't see why it's not good enough for us. The point I wanted to make in my piece, was, in my argument, was there are chances for fraud, but we have no evidence. The question is, can we trust the system? And the fact is, in the absence of evidence that that fraud is being exercised, in the absence of looking at things as they have happened, have we seen examples of that? The answer is, the system theoretically can be manipulated. At the large scale level, it has not been systematically or significantly manipulated. So consequently, in the absence of proof to the contrary, we can trust our elections.
Okay. I got a lot of problems with what you said. No, what's that?
A challenger to a feat of strength, but should win.
So I wanted to go through some of the specifics that you talked about. You divvied everything up into registration, casting of ballots, and counting of ballots. And I had a few thoughts on each of those things. So first off, when we talk about registration of voters, we really do have some major problems with our system of registration, and it varies heavily by state. And it varies heavily by how much a Secretary of State desires to clean up voter rolls. I think it was in 2008 that Pew did a study showing that one out of every voter registrations in the country is invalid. And you rightly point out that having an invalid registration, wait, my husband's correcting me in the front row. Oh, one out of every eight, sorry. One out of every eight voter registrations is invalid. Having an invalid voter registration does not mean that fraudulent ballots are necessarily being cast, but it certainly makes it much easier to have fraudulent ballots cast when you have people who are improperly registered. But I have a few examples of things that are worth thinking about. In Wisconsin, in 2020, because of COVID, the county clerks in the two most Democrat counties, which are Dane and Madison, does that sound right?
Dane is Madison.
Dane and Milwaukee, sorry. Dane and Milwaukee allowed people to register to vote without any verification of who they were. Now, again, that doesn't mean that the people who registered to vote were necessarily fraudulently voting, but it makes it much easier if you want to. And Milwaukee is one of those cities that has such a history of problems with voter manipulation that they used to even have a police task force that was handling it until Democrats actually shut it down because it was a little too effective. I tell that story in the book. In Michigan, you have Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, who just automatically registers people to vote. And if they don't want to be registered, they have to say that they don't want to. Like in Wisconsin, that would be unconstitutional, because in Wisconsin, people have a right to participate in the voting process. They also have a right not to participate in the voting process. But again, just registering people willy-nilly creates opportunities for problems that are very difficult to detect. In Georgia, there was an important issue, which actually is the only sort of big scale issue of, technically it's fraud, that I found when I was reporting the book. And what happened there is, in Georgia, it is illegal to vote in a county that you do not live in. And the margin of victory in 2020 in Georgia was like 11,000 votes, I think. Far more than 11,000 people voted in the wrong county than where they were registered. And you think again, well, they were real people, probably. They really did intend to vote, and it actually probably wouldn't have affected the presidential election. It's the one, or one of the few races in which they voted that would not have been affected. But there are other issues, such as when you are a legal voter and you care about following the law, and you choose not to vote because you're not registered in the county where you live, even if you were registered in the previous county, that disenfranchises you relative to the lawbreakers. It's a really important issue that everyone follow the law. And of course, those people were voting in elections for positions that in places that they didn't live, you know, whether that was mayor or state legislature or state senate. Okay, sorry, that was my point one, registration. On two, casting of ballots, I wanted to clarify that the issue in North Carolina that you talked about wasn't a recent, it was a congressional race where Mark Harris was elected, and the election was overturned because of election fraud. But the fraud that was in place there was exactly what you talked about happening in California. It was the trafficking of ballots. Ballot trafficking is where, you know, where a third party person comes in and gets people to vote or handles their ballot that is illegal in North Carolina, but perfectly legal in California. And it does, again, compromise the integrity of elections when you're caring about caring about security and caring about, you know, whether the will is being in place. It's also a big issue when you have large outside funding. So one of the operations that Mark Zuckerberg was funding through these like left-wing organizations was ballot trafficking. And the funding that Zuckerberg's groups did was highly focused. Like they technically funded both Republican and Democrat counties, but the way they did that was with huge disparities. Mm-hmm. So they funded large blue areas with tens of millions of dollars in a given state, and they'd give $5,000 to a Republican county. So it's not really the same thing. And so if you can put all that resource into trafficking ballots that you are pretty confident are going to matter for a local election, or more commonly, for the how the state would vote for president and for senator, it was a really heavy meddling that determined outcomes. Okay, finally, on counting of ballots. It's kind of interesting. I think, you know, people get all upset about machines, and I think I would trust a machine more than I would trust, say, the people of Philadelphia to accurately count it. But speaking of Philadelphia, just, I think, in 2020, a former Democrat congressman and a former Democrat election judge were convicted of rigging voting machines. The issue with machines is that you do have to, I mean, you have to kind of know what the issues are. When I was writing the book, of course, it became a big issue for people on the right, these voting machines, but all of the material about it is from the left. And that's because, you know, Democrats have had a history of refusing to accept election results for presidential elections that they don't win. And that looks different in different years. In 2004, they adopted a conspiracy theory that Karl Rove had secretly hacked the voting machines in Ohio to deliver George W. Bush's re-election victory. There was this Emmy-nominated HBO series called Hacking Democracy, and they held hearings in the Senate like every single year on election machines, which they were convinced were a problem. The truth of the matter is that they actually are not necessarily secure, which is different than saying you've seen evidence that they weren't secure in recent elections. But there really are problems. And some of the problems aren't even about like intentional fraud. So there's this University of Minnesota academic who's noted that if there's a problem with a machine where someone intends to vote for a race for one person and it comes out for someone else, even when they print out a sample of how you voted, most people will not catch that they voted for that the machine registered the wrong person, if it does register the wrong person. Like very few people will catch that, like 7% of the people that they tested. So there are issues there that can also compromise the integrity. But there, I'm done responding. Do you have anything you want to fight back on me on that, Henry?
Henry, last word.
Okay.
Yeah, you're never going to have completely clean registration rules, you know, because people do die, people do move, human error. Doesn't mean we can't clean them up. But again, the question is this rise to the level that when you wake up on November 6th or November 8th, you know, I guess the election's November 8th, so when you wake up on November 10th and enough of these votes are counted, should you believe the results? And I'd say again, unless you see evidence that there's just unusual things going on in places, there are practices I don't think should be allowed. But it doesn't mean that it's resulting in anything that is casting any doubt on the election. With respect to the ballot trafficking, it wasn't ballot trafficking as much as it was ballot marking. What this guy was doing in North Carolina was going around and not only picking up the ballots, he was getting them empty and marking them for the candidate who paid them. So there's a difference between ballot trafficking, where somebody picks up a ballot that somebody else has filled out, and ballot marking, where you take an empty ballot and you mark it yourself. That's what the guy in North Carolina was doing. I don't like ballot trafficking. I think it should be illegal. But that's not what was going on in North Carolina. It was not that he was taking ballots that somebody had legally cast, because if it had, it wouldn't have been outcome determinative. It would have been a case where he would have been guilty, but it would not have cast a doubt on the outcome of the election. The fact is he was marking the ballots, not simply trafficking them. And with respect to the question of machines, most places I don't think you have a case where the machine is marking the ballot for you, but I remember during 2020, Sidney Powell's group was sending around various academic studies, and they sent one talking about the issue that Molly raises of people not checking their ballot. And within the study, which I read, the person said, that's not likely to happen for high-profile races, because people notice whether they know who they voted for president and stuff. It's likelier to happen that they're not going to check the 15th or 18th race on the circuit court clerk. That's where most of these ballot rigging things take place, like in Philadelphia, rigging the election of the county court, because people don't necessarily know or care who they voted for an obscure local court. That's where you have to be concerned. Again, yes, it's happened. They do catch it. They may need to catch it in more often cases, but when we're talking about the races you and I really care about, the races that change the course of the country, there's really no suggestion. There's really no evidence that what's going on is Philadelphia is racking up 20,000 votes for Democrats that are either dead or non-existent people because they're in control of the voting machines. The fact is, if they were doing it, we'd be seeing things with respect to turnout level and margins that we're simply not seeing because similar areas in Philadelphia and Detroit and Milwaukee vote nearly identically to demographically identical areas in areas where they don't control the voting process. And I have to ask you, trust me, because I've stared at more precinct results. I've actually looked at almost every precinct on the New York Times 2020 color map. So, you know, it's just, if this was happening, you'd see patterns. And you'd say, oh, well, that's suspicious, that's unusual. You don't see it. So I think, yes, I would adopt most of the sort of things Molly is talking about. But that doesn't mean you can't trust what the election results are.
All right, thank you very much for those presentations. We have a little time for some questions. I would take us back to this morning with Bob Ault's excellent admonitions to everyone. I will incorporate them by reference here in lawyerly fashion. I will only re-summarize them by stating, please do keep your questions crisp and ending with a question mark. With that, sir.
Yes, I'm Charles Mills. I'm retired, but I still teach at Padre Pio Academy 3 hours a week. Mrs. Hemingway, I see that you and everybody else I've ever heard talk on this subject skip over the most contentious and difficult presidential race in American history, which was when Tilden was supposedly elected president by one electoral vote based on a one-vote party line vote of a commission that Congress punted to decide the three states that were disputed. I wish you would comment a little bit on that, because I regard any history of American elections as deficient when it ignores the biggest problem that ever occurred in it. Thank you.
Well, what is the specific thing you want commented on there? I'm not sure if I can, but I'm not sure what you're...
Well, there were a number of really things that were commented. The fact that Congress punted to a committee with a one-vote Republican majority on the committee rather than doing its duty. The fact that in three states, the votes that were actually cast were different from the way they were finally awarded. Those are two significant problems in that election. It just seemed to me that if you're going to go through a history of troubled elections, of possibly fraudulent elections, that this is such a blatant case that it should be included.
Well, it should be discussed. And I do think one of the things that's interesting about people's lack of knowledge of contentious elections is they act like what happened in 2020 was the first time you'd had such contests or such disagreement, or even the first time we discovered that the way that we count electoral votes might have some problems. But I'm not sure how much more I can add to that.
Okay, this one comes in from Slido to both Molly and Henry. Do you think it would be advisable to limit early voting in order to avoid people voting weeks or more than a month before Election Day?
I mean, that's what I was talking about with what Attorney General Barr said, which I completely agree, that there's something healthy about people going through a campaign together, coming to a decision together, and voting. You know, I've become somewhat reactionary about it through researching this book. I'd never even really thought about it or cared about it before doing so. But I really think people should vote on Election Day, get it counted immediately, too, is an important part of the process so that people can kind of have a reasonable amount of time that they're waiting, which should be very short, and they can all kind of come together, find out together, and move on together. Early voting, the one thing that's interesting about all the voting integrity issues that are out there, they're broadly popular. Like, voter ID is an 80% issue. Everyone agrees that there should be voter ID, like voter ID, even if President Biden says it's Jim Crow 2.0. But early voting and mail-in balloting, which really do cause problems for the security of our elections and confidence of our elections, are also very popular. So I don't know how popular it is to limit it, but people, if they thought about it, they really should limit it.
Yeah, I don't favor eliminating early voting. I think.
Well, how long do you want it to be?
How long do I want it to be? I like the Georgia law. You know, what the Georgia law says is you have early in-person voting about 2 weeks ahead of time. And I'm in Virginia, so I can go in and vote. I think that's a little long. I don't have a problem with mail voting. I do think we should require more in terms of attestation and identification. And I don't think you should be on a permanent mail voting list. You know, if my 80-something-year-old father has to go in every 5 years in person to get his driver's license renewed, I don't see why any person shouldn't have to go in every 4 years to show that they're actually a person casting their mail vote. But the thing is that most people don't vote that early. And the ones that do tend to be extremely partisan. You know, what you find when you look at the day-to-day voting is that people do put it off to the last week, by and large. You know, a large number, now that we're out of the pandemic, which created a massive fear, what we've seen in 2021 in the primaries is that when there's early voting, people tend to vote in the last week to 10 days. There are many who don't, but presumably, like me, the people who don't aren't going to change their mind. You know, there's not a whole lot that a Democrat's going to say that's going to make me want to vote for them, okay? So I go and I cast my Republican ballot when it's convenient. But independents and other people do wait till the last week. So most people are waiting until the end. You know, that said, I don't have a problem with eliminating, but I don't see what the advantage of. If we're going to go back to the old system, we need to fund elections a lot more than we did, so you don't have the ridiculous queues that were regular before we legalized widespread early voting. I think it is a disincentive to voting to have to stand in line for an hour or two. You know, I've stood in lines for an hour or more to vote because there are simply not enough funding to have people vote on a reasonable basis.
I do think it should be noted there's subtext here. There's political parties like to pretend that they're very principled in why they support election issues one way or the other. But the subtext is that Democrats have had a history of having trouble with enthusiasm from voters. So even if they have a tremendous number of voters, they have people who don't feel very good about voting Democrat, or they're not able to like get out on election day. It's why people used to joke that rain was good for Republicans on election day, because anything that would even further depress Democrat turnout was helpful. And widespread mail-in balloting and early balloting is really a scheme to just make sure that all of that lack of enthusiasm can be tackled over the course of months, as opposed to what they had to do previously, which was tackle it all on a single day. And so that's why, again, Mark Zuckerberg's massive funding scheme and other massive funding schemes are such an important issue. I will point out that Joe Biden issued an executive order in March of 2021, taking that Zuckerberg model and sort of putting it into federal agencies. He required all federal agencies to get involved in election administration, whether that's registration, trafficking of ballots, or otherwise. And that's significant because, in general, we avoid having federal agencies get involved in elections. It can appear to be a form of compulsion when the person who's giving you a welfare check is also asking you to participate in the voting process. And then also there are the issues that the types of voters or potential voters that they may be in contact with will overwhelmingly support the Democrat Party relative to the Republican Party. When state constitutions say that they want free and fair elections, this is the issue that they're actually saying. They want not that level of meddling, whether it's from one of the world's most wealthy men or from the federal government or anyone else who just has a way of kind of getting into the process and jiggering things in a way that's advantageous to their political interests.
Yeah, and what I would say just is, you know, first of all, there's really no evidence that Zuckerbucks actually increased.
Not true.
Well, when I've looked at the various counties where Zuckerberg was in, they didn't have as high an increase in voting turnout as they as places that didn't receive them in similar areas. So the question is, if Zuckerbucks increased turnout in Philadelphia, you have to believe that Philadelphia voters or Pittsburgh voters were uniquely uninterested in an election that seemed to motivate people everywhere. The same is true in Fulton County, which I looked at 2 days ago.
So the Cesar Rodney Institute, which has a team of econometricians, did regressions on in Texas, Wisconsin, and I think they're working on Georgia now and Pennsylvania. And their analysis, and they use a Bayesian model, it's very complicated, but their analysis is that the influence of Zuckerbucks, that Zuck didn't actually need to spend as much money as he did. He could have probably gotten the same result with about $80 million, which is, interestingly, the amount that they're spending on the upcoming cycle. That it did generate a really tremendous number of additional votes for Biden. So in Texas, it was like an additional 200,000 votes for Biden than otherwise would have been expected. In Wisconsin, it was greater than the margin, but I can't remember exactly what it was. Do you remember, Mark? Okay. But it's really interesting studies, and there are these very wonky things, but I would say it's a complicated analysis, but it's an important one to go through.
All right, let me jump in and see if we can get another question from the floor.
Preston Knoll, Tradition Family and Property. So I have a friend who would be here, but he had to leave. He's an attorney from Brazil, been living in the United States since 1980 legally, and he doesn't understand our system, very simple. He said in Brazil, backward Brazil, everybody has a federal voter ID card given by the government. Why can't we do something like that here? That would get rid of all the problems with the non-citizens and everything else. That's my question.
We could have that's one thing a lot of countries do. It's not just Brazil, you know, that you get mailed to you, usually mailed. I've looked at Germany and Sweden and they do that. You get mailed to you a voter identification card, and if you vote by mail, you have to deposit the card in the mail, and if you vote in person, you have to go up and show the card. We could do that if we wanted to. No reason. I mean, I'm not sure if we could do it federally, because Brazil is more of a unitary system. I think we could do it for federal elections, but then you would have a different state election versus federal election, and people may not want to do it, but we could. And then that would require federal registration as opposed to state, that would federalize elections. But there's no reason why we could not federalize elections for federal elections if we wanted to, but then there are disadvantages to that.
I think the Constitution's pretty clear that states are to handle place and manner of elections, so it would be. It is also true that the Democrat Party is very much wanting to federalize these things and exert federal control. That's what HR1 was about. They're pushing through some of these things even now with the Electoral Count Act. But in general, it can be very frustrating that states have different manners of counting and handling elections. But it is a nice constitutional provision, I think.
All right. Yes, sir.
How's it going? Andrew Cuff. My question is mostly for Mr. Olson, but it could be for both. So it's about government-funded election rigging. And you mentioned the California recall election. There was a woman that I know from an organization called the UCLA Latino Policy and Politics Initiative. She described how Latino voters were mobilized for this election. She said, "What we saw is that it was civil society organizations that were going into low propensity neighborhoods. These are the voters that are registered to vote, but need that mobilization to actually cast a ballot." She's saying that's a good thing. It's ballot trafficking, right, as you mentioned. It's funded by labor unions, which are funded by taxpayer dollars, public sector labor unions. I think this is related to the Biden DOJ giving $10 billion for voter initiatives in 2021, as you mentioned. So if the government is funding, or taxpayers rather, are funding a lot of these initiatives, how does that impact our ability to trust our elections?
Yeah, I don't like the sorts of things that the Biden administration is doing. With respect to, it's not clear from what you said that this is money that's funding this as opposed to funding the institutions that are doing it. Look, the bottom line with an election, with whether you can trust the elections, is whether or not the people who are casting the ballots are legal and whether or not the ballots are being counted in an accurate manner. You know, unless you're going to argue that somehow what they're doing is, if they're marking these ballots for people and bringing them in, well, that's illegal. It may not represent their real will, but there's really no evidence that the people are doing that. And in the absence of that evidence, I think what we have to do, particularly in light that there are a lot of people who look at these things at granular details, and you just don't see the sort, again, places like North Carolina stand out because you do see that sort of difference in pattern that suggests, hey, there's something amiss here. In the absence of that, I think what you have to do is assume that this is politicking as normal and that legal voters are casting legal ballots and that it actually represents what their will is. And no, I don't think that Biden should be mobilizing voter turnout or there should be Zuck bucks, but I'd be interested to read the Caesar Rodney study because the places that I looked at, to believe that it actually resulted in significant voter turnout, again, you would have to believe that only the places that Zuck bucks was funding had no interest in the election or less interest in the election, which just doesn't smell right.
Henry pointed out that I had failed to really take a position on the question, can we rely upon our elections as legitimate? Can we trust these things? And one of the things about what you just said that speaks to, if I were to respond, I would say the problem with our election system as it is put together right now is that we just don't know so much. And not being able to have confidence is a huge problem. You said, we just don't have evidence that there was a problem. And that is actually largely true. But when you have a system designed around tens of millions of unsupervised ballots, you're never going to have evidence. That's the point. I mean, you talk about this North Carolina situation. Well, we had reason to believe that this person was marking ballots, and I'm sorry that I'm not more familiar with his ballot trafficking operation. But when you have all these tens of millions of ballots going out into the ether, and they're going any number of places, and we also have federal laws that make it very difficult to even investigate election issues. Like, you can get in trouble for asking someone if they voted in an election that they were supposed to have voted in. In certain states, you can go to prison for asking that question. So when you can't investigate, and you don't have oversight, and you can't audit anything, and you can't determine anything, that's not healthy for our system. Not having definitive proof of some major problem is not the same thing as saying, therefore, you should feel confident.
Well, yeah, the flip side of that is, if there's problems, let's put it this way. If you're going to try and convict somebody of actually committing a crime, you have to have proof the crime was committed. If somebody's going to be committed of robbing a bank, you actually have to show that there's money missing from the bank. Is there any significant evidence? I say significant because I don't doubt that there's places where, Jose votes illegally or somebody decides that they really hate Donald Trump, so they're gonna vote at their vacation home in Florida and their vote in New York. It's kind of like the difference between a crime rave and random cases of burglary. Every community, no matter how safe, has random cases of burglary. We also can figure out where places are crime-ridden. What you don't have is evidence that these things are happening. And the thing is, you'd be able to tell. You'd be able to have the sort of smoke that would lead you to investigate where there's fire. You would see things like unusual margins. You would see things like unusual increases in turnout. You would see things like unusual levels of activity. You would see things like unusual activation of non-active voters, something. And a lot of this, people can look, I had one person in February of 2021, I was over at his house and we were talking about the election. He said, I know there wasn't any voter fraud in Arizona, or that voter fraud didn't shift to Arizona. I said, how do you know that? I said, well, I was hired by the RNC to make the phone calls to try and find it, and we didn't find it. calling the male voter, say, well, are you a legal voter? The thing is that I think that you should presume a system is innocent unless it's demonstrated guilty. In order to demonstrate a system is guilty, let me just finish my sentence, Molly. In order to demonstrate a system is guilty, you have to have some way of saying, here's the evidence that leads me to believe it is guilty, as opposed to, here's how an enterprising fraudster could commit the crime if they so desired.
Again, I think the question is, do people have reason to have confidence in their elections? This is particularly important when you're having very close elections. And we had an election recently, which came down to 43,000 votes across three states. That's a really tiny margin. It followed another election that came down to like 80-some thousand votes across three states. When elections are close, it is reasonable to look into what made differences and what determined the outcome. So you're looking for, before we even talk about like recent elections, we can talk about the recent period of time in which you've had people being willing to do incredibly crazy things because they say that they need to for the sake of the Republic, whether that's ginning up a really insane conspiracy theory that the 2016 election was stolen because Donald Trump was a secret agent who colluded with Russia, turning that into a special counsel probe, having our corporate media lean completely into that, making, to this day, a majority of Democrats think that the 2016 election was illegitimate and that it determined the outcome. That's sort of like the scene in which we then have a widespread orchestrated campaign led by the same guy who ran the Russia collusion hoax, Mark Elias, to change hundreds of laws and processes, enabling tens of millions of mail-in ballots to come into the system. Sometimes those changes happened legally and constitutionally. Sometimes those changes did not happen constitutionally. Sometimes he would just sue a friendly state official who would agree to his list of demands about how to make an election in the way that he wanted it to be, coordinating with an army of left-wing groups and having this $419 million to manipulate the system to run Democrat get-out-the-vote operations in the blue areas of swing states. And again, we're talking about states that had very tiny margins that determined the outcome. Mm-hmm. And we do know that when you run get-out-the-vote operations, that they bear fruit. That's why political parties do them so much. And that's why it's important that you don't do it inside the government from one party's perspective. It's like if you were the Redskins are playing the Cowboys, and the Cowboys are, training the referees, paying the referees, handling every aspect of the administration of the game, and then there's a close call, and then you say, well, there's no evidence that they did anything wrong. It's unreasonable to say that people should therefore have confidence in the system. And we should all care about not having like really wealthy people or really powerful regime operatives controlling aspects of our elections, because we don't have a republic if we can't trust it. Right now, it's people on the right who are feeling this way. It wasn't that long ago that people on the left were as well. We should care much more about the integrity of these elections and doing everything that we can that people can have confidence in them.
All right. Let's finish up with questions from the floor tonight, so please, sir.
My name is Harley Price. I'm a refugee from Canada whose principal export, as it happens to be, our most famous export of late, is rigged voting machines. I want to bring up something, or would like you to comment on something which it seems to me is immediately germane to the question of having confidence in elections, which neither of you has mentioned. Or two things that neither of you has mentioned. One are polls that pretend to predict outcomes when their real purpose is to influence outcomes. And the other is the seems to me, the elephant in the room, which is a one-party press. I long ago lost confidence in elections, decades ago, because of the fact that in North America and probably in Western Europe, we have, in effect, the same kind of press as existed in the Soviet Union for the last 70 years, under which the idea of a free and fair election is simply unthinkable.
Okay, I definitely have thoughts on this really quickly.
Go for it.
Okay, so in the book that I wrote on election issues, I actually, both of those things are major points I focus on. So with polling, we see so much, like polling affects the way people think, mostly in this town, mostly in DC. It affects what they think is possible. It affects how they talk about things. And so, you know, usually by the end, usually by the time of election day, the polls kind of get to within a place of somewhat reasonable place. In the summer preceding an election, the polls are absurd. They can be, they serve mostly like to demoralize people. There is the great example though in 2020, the Washington Post, Henry's paper, put out a poll saying that Wisconsin was going to go for Biden by 17 points. That is nothing other than like propaganda. Nobody believed that. That would be insane to think, even if the candidates were wildly different. Of course, it ended up being within one point. But that's what happens day after day after day. You know, and I go on TV at night, and so every night we're talking polls, and the polls are always the same. And they never fix them. They're always biased in the same direction. And it's a huge, huge problem. Sometimes the advent of some new pollsters who are less media allied or less institutionally academic allied can be better, but people would be wise to disregard them as much as possible. I bet you disagree.
Well, I disagree, but not in the way you think I would disagree. I don't think people, the average voter, knows or cares much about polls. You know, it matters to us, but we're partisans. I've never seen any indication that adverse poll results suggests that people on the margin go with the side that appears to be ahead in the polls. And in fact, we've got tons of examples of the contrary. You know, like, let's take a look at Australia. In 2019, Australia's poll showed the center-left coalition of Labor and Greens winning. I think they led in every single poll for a two-year period except one. And the party that won were the Liberal National Coalition. Why? Because people aren't making, it does shape insider expectations. That I agree with, absolutely. Does it shape voting behavior? I don't see that. And I do think there is a problem in the West generally, that there is, for whatever reason, a left-wing bias in polls. And I think it's because there's a certain type of person that they, the dirty secret of polling is that because of non-response bias, people not responding anymore, they approximate a random sample rather than actually have one. Right. So polling theory works if you actually have a random sample. But because you can't get a random sample because of polling non-response bias, what pollsters do is weight polls according to various demographic characteristics. That solves some of the problem, but it also means if the pollster's wrong about the weights, the pollster's wrong about the election. Mm-hmm. And you can only weight up what you can measure. So if there's a subset of people who tend to be Republican-leaning and non-college-oriented or non-college-educated who are not answering polls, they don't have to be very large to skew the polls by 2, 3, or 4 points. And I think that's what we see. We had the Swedish election last Sunday. Exit polls, which shouldn't be prone to error like this. One exit poll said the left was going to win by 2.5 points. The other said they would win by less than a point. The right won by less than a point.
All right.
Surprise me.
Yeah, I want to give Molly the last word. Time is waning.
Okay. I do want to say really quickly, I was thinking about, there's this TV show called Narcos. I bet it's a very big hit in this room. It's about Mexican drug cartels. And in the second season, the head of the cartel figures out he can rig elections merely by rigging polling. And it's a really interesting thing. I know it's a TV show. But the reason why it matters is it does affect the other issue you talk about, which is media. The way that the polling affects the media discussion is tremendous. So think about it again in 2020. The discussion beginning in about May, June of 2020, leading all the way through the election, is that it is absurd to think that Donald Trump can win. And boy, is it a disaster. And how can this like even happen? And he's down by 12 points in the national polls. And it affects not just like the angle from which you have to debate things on TV, which is unfortunately where most people get their news and information, but it also has a tremendous effect on like the people who make decisions that can then also play into elections. And I'm thinking here, Attorney General Barr, who I have a high regard for, said pretty early that the polling meant that Trump was not going to win again. How does him thinking that affect how hard he's going to fight on an issue he actually cares about, which is the problems with mail-in balloting? How much is he going to put into that knowing that Trump is about to lose anyway? And he's already battered by everybody in the corrupt propaganda press. That's just like one cabinet official, but it extends to an entire bureaucracy. And then when you're not doing stuff to fix mail-in balloting, it can actually affect the results of the election. International observers say that if you have a propaganda press, you do not have free and fair elections. We have a propaganda press. They lie, they make up stories. They win Pulitzers for pushing the Russia collusion hoax. They win awards for, I'm sorry, I know it's not you because you're good and you write good columns, but your paper pushed the lie that Russia was paying to kill American troops in Afghanistan. Not true. They also helped push the lie that The Atlantic originated, that Donald Trump had called soldiers suckers and losers. These are all lies. They're not true. They were refuted by dozens of on-the-record sources. And there's no repercussions for it. And it does affect elections. It gets into debates, and it gets into people's consciousness, and it is a horrific threat to the Republic.
All right, so please join me in thanking both of our panelists. We're out of time. Keep your seats. I'd like to ask RJ Prestito up to the podium for just a couple of announcements.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, to my left, ladies and gentlemen, I'm speaking to you to my left. Just a moment, please. So we do have this reception that's coming up. I'm only going to take about a half an hour to wrap up. Would you please lock the doors at the back of the room? Just to briefly introduce the concept that's going on in this reception. We're going to have hors d'oeuvres back there. It's going to be to celebrate our Future of Freedom Fellows. This, again, to remind you, it's the John W. Pope Foundation, which has launched this initiative, which seeks to refresh and to rebuild and to revitalize the conservative movement in America. And so with their generous support, the Philadelphia Society has created this fellowship program. The idea is to cultivate and support rising leaders dedicated to enhancing the future of freedom in the United States. Are there any of them in the room still? Those who are central to the future, stand up, please. There's only one of you, so you should take a bow. No, there you are. Okay. So, thank you. Thank you. So please do try to meet these folks if you can. There are QR codes. We like QR codes at Philadelphia Society. So they will have the bios of these fellows if you are interested in learning more. Again, just to thank everybody for coming out. This has been a recent record in terms of attendance. I think our panelists did an excellent job, and also the staff. Not only the hotel staff, but the Philadelphia Society staff. Chris Arule is in the back of the room. If you would thank her as well, please. So So Indianapolis, that's the next location, 2023 spring meeting. We look forward to seeing you all there. Thank you.